Good afternoon. We will get the meeting started today. Thanks for being here. We're Oakland University Senate meeting of March 21, 2019. So, happy spring. First up on the agenda are several information items, and I'll take them in the groups outlined here. So there are, first up, program modifications approved by Graduate Council. There's A and B. Are there any questions about A and B? All right, seeing none, under number two, program modifications approved by the University Committee on Undergraduate Instruction. Several of these, one from School of Music, Theater, and Dance, SBA, Health Sciences, all the way onto the next page through I. These are program modifications. Do we have any questions about these items? Okay, I hope Brian Fox is ready then. Thank you very much. We'll move on to item number three, student mental health and student success. Ryan Fox.
All right. Well, that's a lot more sensitive than I thought it was. All right, then. So I'll just get right into it. Hello, everyone, members of the Senate. It's an honor to be in front of you all today. So my name is Ryan Fox. For those of you who don't know me, I'm the soon-to-be outgoing student body president here at OU. And as a de facto of that position, I sit on the Student Academic Support Committee, which is, here's a full list of our members. It's chaired by the wonderful Henry Agbido, who's sitting in the back there. Hi, Henry. Fantastic individual. But I sit as a member on this committee of a total of 13. And the point of the committee is to focus on student academic success. And what ways, what actions can the university do to make students successful academically? So the student representatives on the committee, myself and a few others, we got together, we talked with fellow students, and asked kind of what problems are they facing that's impairing them academically. And there was one resounding connective factor, and it was all the issue of mental health. Not only is this an issue at OU's campus, but it's also a national crisis going on right now. So here's some statistics here in front of you all. 75%, I'm not going to read everyone out completely because I know you are all very capable of reading slides, but so 75% of lifetime cases of mental health emerge by age 24. That is our demographic. Yeah. Majority of folks who have lifelong conditions discover them while they're in college. So that means that this affects their ability to succeed in the classroom. Going further on, 36% of students have lifetime diagnoses, and that is an increase of almost 40% over the past 10 years. So we see as time goes on, the problem is only getting worse and worse. Going even further, we've seen an increase in suicide rates amongst young people, and it is now the third leading cause of death in the United States of young people. So overall, a very big problem. But how does it relate to academics? So academic impairments that students typically experience. So a ACHA report released in 2011, keep in mind that's about 8 years ago now, the problem has only gone worse as time has gone on, cite that depression and anxiety are among the top impediments to academic performance. 31% of college students have felt so depressed in the past year that it was difficult to function, and over 50% report overwhelming anxiety. To put that in perspective, we're talking 1 in 3 of the students that sit in your classrooms have experienced depression so high they have a trouble functioning, and 1 in 2 have overwhelming anxiety. So that impairs their ability to turn in assignments on time, as well as the tests and things like that. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation found that mental health is one of the leading causes behind students dropping out. So also talking from a retention perspective. I know retention is a word that's thrown around an awful lot here at the university. Mental health is integral to that conversation, and making sure that students succeed is integral as well. So we need even more specific. Impact specifically on Oakland University. So throughout my tenure as president, I've had many meetings with Dr. Schwartz. He's the director of OU's Counseling Center, and he's provided many of these statistics, as well as a report that he did with the ACHA about OU specifically. So since 2012, October of 2012, over the past 6 years, there's been a 246% increase in requested emergency crisis hours here at OU, showing that the demand for OU's mental health services is just going up and up as time goes on. Roughly 40% of students report that their grades have been impacted by stress. 31% specifically cite anxiety. So that is, again, huge numbers we're talking about here. Wait times at OU Counseling Center has also not been super helpful. A fall semester alone, some students had 3-week wait times all the way up to 6-week to 10-week wait times because of the backlog. Temporary staff was hired, which has helped reduce the problem, but it does serve as a very strong indicator that the request for these services is going up and up as time goes on. So some of you might be wondering, if 1 in 2 students is having problems with anxiety, why is this the first time I've heard this statistic? And part of it is because sometimes there are difficulties reaching out to students and getting them to seek the help that they need. So stigmatization is a huge factor. There was a study done by UCLA that shows that a lot of times students will avoid getting help because they're worried about how their families are going to feel about it. They're worried about how their peers are going to feel about it, how other professionals are going to think about it. So the stigma is not helpful. Students will also downplay their needs as well. So students who do reach out for help when they're being triaged will sometimes underreport their symptoms, and this can happen for a multitude of reasons. So this could be because a student is having trouble coming to grips with the fact that they're having these problems, all the way to, again, that stigma, they're worried what their family's going to think, so on and so forth. Students often don't know exactly where to get help, which is a big one. If I'm working as a full-time student and I work a job, if I can't find resources quickly, I might just give up completely because, why bother? I'll just keep going how I'm going. And then also, as I mentioned before, the counseling center wait times are very long. If I'm a student who's stressed out and has reached out for help, if the counseling center tells me I got 3 to 6 weeks to wait, I might just say, forget about it. I'll just keep going the way I'm going. So what are the goals of our committee for this presentation? Why are we having this conversation? So we have 5 here. 1, obviously we want to promote student success and hopefully potentially save a life in the future. Increasing student awareness of resources. I'll kind of get in a little bit later about the best way to do that, or one of the best ways to do that we determined. Improving retention. Again, practically speaking, the university does a lot better when students stay enrolled. So if we can improve retention any way possible, that would be fantastic. Provide resources for faculty, and I'll get to that in the next few slides. For staff to be able to assist students, so you guys have information ready for a student that might need it. You can just pass that right along. And also just increase conversations. In many ways, this presentation is part of that goal. Just having this conversation where we can be open about mental health and talk about what it's doing to students and so on, that'll help reduce the stigma, so that way students feel more comfortable reaching out for help. So the next steps. So what are we asking of you all? We're asking you to please include OU Counseling Center's information on your syllabi. Even though there are long wait times, OU Counseling Center is able to give information for other mental health resources in the area to benefit students, and that is huge. Make sure your colleagues have it on their syllabi, because many of the folks sitting in this room, though there are many of you, you're only a small fraction of all the faculty around this university. So if you could help make sure that your colleagues are thinking about this and that your departments are thinking about this, as goal number 4 says, that would be incredibly helpful. And also, don't just put it on syllabi and forget about it. Mention it in class. Talk about how sometimes students just need help, and it's all right to reach out for help. And talk about the different resources that are available. Have these conversations, and again, reduce the stigma. So I wouldn't just ask you to do something without providing a way to do it. So we have this recommended addition to the syllabi that the committee came out with. 2 big key factors. It has the phone number for OU Counseling Center. So that way students can call. But it also includes a website. www.oakland.edu/deanofstudents. So the Dean of Students right now has a tab on its website called the Student Health and Safety Resources tab, and that currently has a great deal of resources available. The committee is also looking at changing it so that it adds even more resources later on, and that should be a one-stop shop for if students need assistance or need help finding mental health resources, they can find it on the website. So in conclusion of this all, essentially just help us increase the conversation around this topic. Help us make sure students are getting the help that they need. And before I leave, does anybody have any questions? Anybody at all? All right. Well, thank you very much. I certainly appreciate it.
Thanks, Ryan. I think everyone realizes it's a very important topic. Thank you. Okay, we asked Tricia Westergaard to come in and have a conversation around the grading system for our next item. Right at the end, last semester was the first one where we changed to the grade system. And Right at the end of the semester, there were some communications with my office from students. And there was just a recent conversation, I think, with students at the Ask Aura event. So this, I wanted Tricia to come over and let's have a conversation about it. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Dr. Lentini. Hello, everybody. I'm Tricia Westergaard. I'm the registrar here at OU. And I am here today to provide an update on the new grading scale that was initiated at the request of Student Congress, developed by a committee of faculty, staff, and students, and then ultimately approved by the OU Senate, which we implemented, as Dr. Lentini said, in the fall of 18. So as you recall, we transitioned from a very unique, numerically based grading scale to a very standard and more traditional letter grading scale. I've created a one-page document that we'll soon be communicating out to the campus community as we work towards the April 29th, 10 a.m. grading deadline. Grades help instructors to communicate to students, the university, and society at large about a particular student's levels of knowledge and skill. And I would like to acknowledge the fact that grading is a very difficult task, and yet grading is one of the most recurring tasks in education. As your registrar, I'm not standing here trying to tell faculty how to grade. I respect that that is your area. And I'm just here to share the student experience. I am uniquely positioned in the office of the registrar. I've had faculty contact me. I've had students contact me as well. And that is what I want to offer to you today. There have been some misconceptions about the grading scale. And so that's why I created in conjunction with the provost office this information that I have, and then there's copies available on the table, so hopefully you have that. So as you review the new grading scale, we put some of the more pertinent information to clear up some of the misconceptions that we heard. And really what I want to talk to you about today is that we have 6 academic catalogs that are active for both undergrad and master's level students, and up to 10 years for our doctoral students. And those students are meeting degree requirements that are based largely off of our old numeric scale. So we are in a period of transition. And so my hope is, as we roll into the last month of grading and prepping for the end of the semester, that all of the faculty share this information with your colleagues within each school, with the other faculty members as well, and keep in mind that this is a period of transition and that we're hoping to help students through this transition as best that we can. But most importantly, please share. I think we want as many students to hear about the impact of the grading scale on students as we can. And then one last plug for that final grading deadline of Monday, April 29th at 10 a.m. With that, I'll open the floor up if anybody has a comment or has a question about this document. But I think it's fairly self-explanatory.
David Barker from Physics. I seem to remember at least 3, if not 4, 6, 8 emails that basically had that table at the bottom of, here's how to translate between the old, numerical scale and the new letter scale. So I'm not exactly sure where the talking about is coming from. I mean, as near as I can tell, I've seen this information many times before. So it's the idea that, somehow someone, missed this information, and so we should just give it to them, in the N plus first time, even though they've seen it N times already.
Yes, from my perspective, one more time, one more push as we roll into the final weeks of the semester, because I did hear from some folks that they were not aware of it or of all the implications that the grading scale has on their students' degree requirements. So yes, one more time.
Thank you.
Well, the other thing, just to interject, we had this is a transition period, no doubt. So students have a different perception as well. So we wanted to bring it here to make sure that we. I mean, I hope you're right that we, you know, we get it and it's good, but it seems like we're having a few bumps.
So if I can comment, I'm Mark Navin, associate professor in the college, and I was a member of the grading scale committee, and sort of heard some of this feedback. And one of the questions has been about these translation issues. And if you think about the translation in the wrong way, I think you can get a bit confused. So, for example, if you were starting by thinking, I wanted to give my student the lowest C grade on the old scale, right, then I'd be giving them a 2.0. But then now that turns into a C, which is not the lowest C grade. So is the university now forcing me to inflate my grades from the lowest C grade to now a middle C grade? And that was not the intent at all. Of course, grading is an aspect of academic freedom that is wielded by the faculty, both in the academic units and then as it's delegated to individuals. So the grades that people get are up to faculty. Of course, they should speak the universal language of assessment. Right, and I think these are helpful bullet points, but of course not entirely prescriptive. So maybe that clarifies some of the confusions about how to think of the translation.
Keith Mervin, biology. I think one of the problems that we've had with students is most people, when they give grades, come up with a percentage, and they convert that percentage to a 4-point grade. Now, there is no indication of how percentages assigned to these particular letter grades. And everybody is doing it differently. So this is very confusing to the students. And it's also confusing to the students who are used to a full numerical scale to now see that you go from a B plus to an A minus, and it's all the way from 3.3 to 3.7. On a percentage scale, you know, it doesn't look quite that large. And I don't know, I mean, I mentioned this when this was initially proposed, that I thought it would be helpful if there was a corresponding, more or less standard percentage assigned to each of these letter grades. It's certainly the case that every faculty member can curve their grades in any percentages any way they want. But at least the students would know that if they got an 80%, that corresponded to a particular letter grade. And not, you know, a 0.9 in one person's class and a 3.1 in somebody else's class.
So I think that is definitely the heart of a lot of the confusion with this. But the challenge is that an A in your class might be a different percentage than an A in someone else's class. And so it's so unique to each individual instructor. It is very difficult to have one common, one size fits all. And that's unfortunately just the best place that we're at. But what I do encourage is to make sure that faculty come up with what they feel comfortable and is an adequate representation of the learning in the class and put it on the syllabus and make it very clear to the students so they understand what their percentage that they need to achieve the A minus, the B plus, et cetera.
May I say something?
Yes.
So I think there are further at least two kinds of equity questions, right? And so there's one kind of equity question about if there are different distributions of grades between instructors of the same section in the same academic unit. And so there are good reasons for academic units to work collectively to have a kind of common language of grading, right? So equity among instructors. But then there's also this sort of global equity thing that we're making sure that an A or a B in a class here roughly translates, right? Speaks the same language as A's and B's in other classes. So I've heard of tale of stories of faculty members who are now saying you must have 100% to get an A. Of course, that is your right, or very well might be your right, the way your academic unit is structured. That seems inconsistent with the way in which that A grade is used at most other universities.
I think that's a red herring. If I may chime in. So Ryan Fox, Oakland University Student Congress, public admin and a German language major. I don't know if that's important. But so a great deal of the confusion, I guess the issue that most students, at least in terms of the feedback that I've received with the grading scale, is thankfully at the high end, which means a lot of students care or are in that higher end, which means they care about the higher end. But it's the area that a lot of students existed in, myself included for a time, between the 3.7 and the 4.0. and it was the 3.8 students and 3.9 students who work incredibly hard and worked incredibly hard. So the issue there, though, is that a lot of them don't feel like there is an area for them anymore because 3.8 and 3.9 no longer exist. As you can see, there is a 4.0, 3.7. I guess the intended theory was that a 3.9 was supposed to round up and a 3.8 down. At least that was the theory that was billed to us as time went on. So I think what's important and where most confusion exists is that where essentially most confusion exists is that students are thinking in like the three-point system still instead of in the letters. And when they see an A, they see that as an A. And when they see an A minus, they see it as something awful. And especially I hear a lot specifically from pre-meds and folks that plan on going into grad school because they see it as making themselves less competitive because a 3.7 is, I believe, by average for pre-med. At least that's what I've been informed. Again, I'm not pre-med at all, so take it with a grain of salt. But 3.7 is about average for most applicants to medical schools, while 4.0, at least pre-meds felt that they existed better in a system where they could get a 3.8 or a 3.9. So that is the student perspective that I've received.
I'm not sure I'm the one to respond to that, but just a quick, Ann will, yes, because Ann and I had an exchange about this that I think it might be helpful. So Ann hit.
Good afternoon, everybody. So the thing to remember for pre-med students is that if they had a 3.8 or a 3.9, it was actually turned into an A- and then recalculated in the GPA. So our students were being severely disadvantaged by this. So it was really important as a student success issue to have go to the ACE, the alpha scale, like almost everybody else on the planet. That way, our students are being treated equally as opposed to being disadvantaged. So that's why we did it. Does that make sense? Questions?
Sure. So, yeah, no, and I know that we've had many a meeting about this issue specifically. I guess the key is communication. A lot of students weren't 100% clear on what the new system is. Whether or not whose fault that falls on, I'm not sure, but essentially a lot of students just see that scale and they see it as punishing them. But having more detailed explanations for students as to why the system was changed, a lot of students weren't here were here back when the old system, but they weren't currently in the process of applying to grad schools and med schools that were penalizing them, so they didn't understand. The key is communication and making sure that students fully understand what is going on, as well as faculty as well, which some of the most esteemed faculty here. I understand that for the most part, most people in this room understand what's going on. The problem is I represent students that are not here, and they do not come to these types of things. So these are the ones that really have no idea what is going on. So again, I will just emphasize the importance of communication.
Absolutely. One thing to consider is that this was discussed and published in the Oakland Post back when Nick Walters started it, and I think more recently. That doesn't mean those students were here then, all right? What I would like to suggest, though, for clarity's sake, is that instead of putting the numeric things down there at all, those are strictly for the convenience of the registrar's office. I would suggest on people's syllabi, don't put those numbers. Put your percentage. So it's clear what grade, what percentage or points or whatever equates to a particular alpha grade. That way it will make it much more transparent and less confusing.
I saw some nodding heads. How do we feel okay about that idea? Sounds like reasonable advice.
Yeah, I have something to add about this. I mean, I do agree that we have been told a lot about this and that I did study very carefully trying to figure out the correlation between what I was doing before and what it would mean now. And I think I'm continuing to grade students the way I did, but I'm just surprised that what I used to think of as a B+ is now lower and is a 3.3. So for me to wrap my head around, I may need to go into a re-indoctrination program somewhere and have my brains completely wiped clean and then refilled with this new thing. But it does seem like there is a kind of a long distance between A- and B+ on this one, almost as if it were 3.5 That feels more like a B plus. A 3.0 in my mind has been close to a low B. Now all of a sudden what I have always thought of as a C plus is a B minus. And it really isn't easy to explain to students. If there is no correlation between your own personal grading scale and how it eventually gets translated into their grade point average. So, with the nodding heads and everybody else understanding about not putting numbers on the syllabus and everything like that, I must say this is something that is hard to explain to students, even though I want to.
So I will point out, or not point out, I just like to say, this is the same scale other schools use. This is, I believe, the scale that's used by the K-12 world, or at least most of them. And so it shouldn't be new to our students. The ones that have been here for 3-4 years, I think it may be, they're used to the other scale, but it shouldn't really be new.
Maybe your students were really A-minus. I mean, I think that when I went to school, I probably was using this scale, but, you know, that was then, this is now, and
right.
My brains are,
right.
It does have to do with brains.
Yes. And that's why I would suggest, actually, that people start fresh. All right? And start with, this is the scale, this is the alpha scale we've got, figure out what percentage that equates to, and stick with that. And don't try and do the conversion, because it does, I think, tend to make people get more confused. Okay. I think that's standard across everybody.
So it sounds like some rethinking is required here, re-indoctrination, maybe a little heavy-handed.
Indoctrination, yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Guys, just by way of using a metaphor, this is a new language, right? So the wrong way to think about this is we're exchanging one set of numbers for another set of numbers.
Right.
And when you think that way, right, I think that's intuitive, but that leads us astray, right? So thinking in terms of I feel silly saying this to a language professor, but I think thinking in terms of translating, right, the numbers, right, that's wrong, right? So really, we do need to learn a new language and start fresh in that way.
Would this be like trying to learn Chinese? Which sounds like kind of a hard thing, but I'm game.
I've thought of it like Google Translate, taking German, translating it into French, and then into English, and that's where we are.
I will do my best.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks. And Ryan, I do agree that communication is key here. So while we heard part of a message here that says, why are we even, seen it a lot, it's obvious that students and others need a little more communication. We'll figure out with you and with our office and whoever else can help us with this, how to make sure this is getting translated. I have some hope because, again, it was one semester, and as we go forward, I hope it can get more, everyone gets more used to it. So we'll keep working on it. Okay, thank you. All right, Provost updates. I did State of Academic Affairs, so I'll make this one brief. I will reiterate a couple of points. One, I did say on Tuesday, I'll repeat it here, and I know I've talked about HLC here a couple of times, but we had a draft letter from the committee the last time we had a Senate meeting. Now we have their final letter. This is not a final decision because it still goes to HLC for their approval. But there are 21 standards, criteria that have to be met, 21. We met all 21. So that was great work by everyone. And I know that you know Ann Hitt and Joy Cunningham did a lot of work. There's a compliance piece to that report that Joy did, and I know Joy will always smile and giggle in the hallway if she needs to, but in the first draft letter, there was no mention of the compliance part. So she's an optimistic person, said it must be perfect. So, and it came back, and we were fine on the compliance part, nothing on the compliance end. There are two items while we still passed them. Excuse me, I'm just popping microphone here. There are two items that they want some feedback on, not requiring a visit, not requiring a special and any kind of special efforts other than when we do our next report, they want us to respond to how the assessment program, how we're doing assessment now has been revamped, and they want to see the results of that. So it's not an unreasonable question, so we didn't see that as highly problematic. The other one I did have a question about, and Ann, I don't know what we decided to do. We were maybe going to ask them a question about this. There was a discussion, I happened to be in the room during one of these meetings, about external input in the program review process, and I understood the question. What we can't find is that there's anything written by HLC that says that's a requirement. So we're just trying to get a little clarity on that. It's, again, a minor issue probably, but those were the two things. Out of all the things you read on these lists, those being the two things that we need a little bit of extra, just we need to write it up in our next normal timeline, we ended up really, really in great shape. So we're feeling good about it. So... there's a discussion at Senate this past Tuesday about textbooks, and you've seen in this room a little bit of, at Senate meetings, a little discussion about OER, that was touched on, but there also was a discussion from Jessica in the bookstore working with Julia Rodriguez about making certain, and there are good reasons for us, where possible, to get your textbooks orders in early because for the possibility of saving money for students. And the way it can be negotiated, all these kinds of things makes a big difference. So we're going to be talking more about this. I hope it's a message you'll also relay. I know that we've had messages sometimes in the office say, why are we receiving these messages? I'm not ready to order my textbooks. We do understand, but we do want to make sure that you know that if you order them early, we can save what turns out to be, in some cases, significant, hundreds of thousands of dollars for students if we can get them ordered early. So we'll be talking to you more about it. And Michelle, I don't know if there are any other comments or anyone else in the room who was at the meeting that wanted to talk about that. We'll bring it to chairs again. We've talked about this before. And I know it can be highly problematic when sometimes there are part-time instructors, et cetera, but we're going to do everything we can to try to save our students money along that student success initiative we have. And this is, I don't know if you're following this nationally, what's going on with textbooks. I'm sure you are. But you know, a lot of universities have really pushed hard on this to try and, because so many students have trouble affording books. So we'd like to save them money. I should mention, I saw Kevin Corcoran here earlier. He's there. We are, undertaking doing the Carnegie engagement application. We do a whole lot of engagement work here, both in the volunteer end through student affairs, service learning courses on the academic end. We're not 100% sure we check all the boxes for the way Carnegie wants this application to be put together, but we think we'll learn some things. I'm hoping it's successful, but if not, we will learn a few things. But I wanted you to know about that. And Kevin, I don't know if I assume we're gathering as much information as we can, but if there are people in this room or you know of significant things you would want Kevin Corcoran to know as he's filling out this application, that would be good. What we found when we were looking at all of our community engagement types of activities, whether they be academic, student-oriented, volunteer, it's very hard to keep our fingers on, and we're trying to improve this, of course, any coordinated way of collecting that information. So there could be things we don't know about. If you think that there's something hidden gem that we should know about that you're doing in community engagement or something in your department or area, Do let us know, and certainly Kevin Corcoran know on that end. Oh, let's see. I think that's it. So we'll move on to roll call.
Okay. Dan Alloy?
Here.
Zena El-Saman?
Here.
Kevin Ball?
Here.
Paul Battle?
Here.
Dwayne Baxa?
Here.
Keith Bourbon?
Here.
Anika Bo?
Present.
Louis Chamra? Rasul Chowdhury, Rebecca Cheesham,
here.
Eddie Cheng,
here.
Dan Clark,
here.
Kevin Corcoran,
here.
Mary Craig,
here.
Dominique Daniel,
here.
Debitaj Debna,
here.
Mary Dureski, Judy Didion, Deb Doherty, Dave Dulio,
here.
Chaturi Edrasina, Andrea Ice,
here.
Todd Estes,
here.
Ryan Fox,
here.
David Garfinkel,
here.
Greg Geiberson, Frank Giblin, Henry Gorin, Lila Gesus, Joyce Hofstede, Ann Ranchuk, Mina Ibrahim, Jeff Insko, Brittany Kleinschmidt, Michelle Knox, Mike Lacha, Tom Lauer, Jennifer Law Sullivan, James Lentini, Michael Wong, Jennifer Lucarelli, John Marjoram Lace. That would be Michael Mazio. All right. Jay Meehan. Paul McGee.
Here.
John Meldrum.
Here.
Dwayne Meswa. Ann Mitchell.
I'm on 4.0.
We're using grades.
Ken Mitten. Mark Navin.
Here.
Mohinder Parkesh.
Here.
Joe Rieger. Mark Rigstead.
Here.
Brad Roth.
Here.
David Stone.
Here.
Janelle Townsend.
Here.
Ron Tracy. Bob Van Til. Michael Wadsworth.
Here.
Steve Weider.
Here.
Lisa Welling.
Here.
And Karen Wells. Okay, there's a quorum.
Okay, very good. Are there any corrections to the minutes of February 14th, 2019? Seeing none, we approve the minutes as presented. Thank you. We have one old business item that showed up on your agenda, but it was then realized that this item was not ready, so by consent, we'd like to remove it from the agenda, and we'll bring it back. So I wanted you to know about that. Okay, so the old business is removed. Under new business, we have a motion from the General Education Committee to change the general education requirement from 40 credits. Do I have a motion?
Yes. Move that the Senate approve changing the general education requirement from a requirement to complete 40 credits across 10 knowledge areas to completing the general education requirements, including a course of 3 or more credits in each of the knowledge areas.
Second.
Okay, motion and seconded. Thank you. Discussion is Lori. I don't know if Lori was going to present, or do we have questions, Lori Ostergaard, or do we have questions about this? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Maybe there aren't any, but maybe there are.
So the Gen Ed Committee's been talking about this for about a year. We've brought people in. And the main idea here is that we want students to still take 10 courses within Gen Ed, but oftentimes our transfer students are coming in and they've taken 3 courses, they fulfilled all the areas, and then we're making them take additional courses within the Gen Ed program so that they can fulfill the 40 credits. So, and this program actually makes us competitive, for transfer students. So, for example, Eastern Michigan requires 13 courses and 40 to 41 credits. Grand Valley, 11 to 13 courses. And then requiring 10 courses at whatever credits puts us in line with, for example, Northern Michigan, Michigan State, and others. And the hope is that this will allow some of our transfer students who come in to possibly pursue double majors or even minors. They'll have more free electives, and things will be a little bit sort of easier on the majors that require quite a lot of credits. Any questions? Oh, no, not the philosopher.
No,
nope, I'm out.
I take that personally. So just a clarificatory question. So is it the case, given that there are 10 knowledge areas, that so long as we retained the standard of 4 credits per class, anyone who took all their gen ed credits here would still amass the 40 credits?
Yes.
Right. So this would not by itself, so the immediate consequence is merely for transfer, right, for the gen ed curriculum.
There are some 3 credit gen ed courses within our curriculum right now. This might actually make it possible for there to be more.
Okay.
Credit courses.
But the longer term consequence, when, I don't know which word we're using now for this, we move to the 3 credit hour standard, for class would be this would move the general education curriculum to being able to be satisfied with 30 credits.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Just in follow-up to Mark's question, does it specify 30 credits, though? Because otherwise somebody could come in with 10 classes that were 2-credit hour classes, theoretically, right?
No, actually, it specifies, and I think this is in the motion, it needs to be a minimum of 3-credit courses. So we're not going below. It's not 2 credits plus 1. It's got to be a 3-credit course. Thank you.
Good questions. All right, thank you. This is a first reading. We appreciate the work on this. Very, very important.
Thank you.
Helps our students. Okay, move on to another piece of new business. Motion from motion from the Graduate Council to change the name of Graduate Education to what? Graduate Education to Grad Studies. What it says. Is that what it says on yours?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes, should say Graduate School. Can I make a correction?
No.
It should say motion from the Graduate Council to change the name of Graduate Education to the Graduate School. Oh. That's a little different.
Yeah.
Apologies.
Yeah.
Now, if you read the attachment, the motion, you would know that. So.
Daniel, are you reading?
Okay.
So I know Susan Aubrey's here. If they're,
We need the motion.
Yeah.
Yes.
Aside.
Move that the organization under which the graduate study operates be named the Graduate School of Oakland University.
A second.
Okay. Motioned and seconded. Thank you. Discussion. I know Susan's here. If there are questions, pretty clear motion if you read it, but.
Eddie Chen from Math and Stat. I have a question.
Okay.
So I assume that, I mean, this is partly for recruiting purpose because it makes us look more like the other university?
Yeah, that's right. We're kind of an anomaly right now, especially as we moved up into the R2 category. Very few places have something called, in fact, I have to admit, when I first got to this university, I didn't know what to call it, right? It's graduate ed, grad study. No, it's graduate. Most people call it a graduate school now if they don't know the place well. It's just sort of it's a name change is really what we're looking at.
Well, it's me again. Since we are still in recruiting season, so I motion to waive second reading.
Is there a second?
Second.
Motioned and seconded. Wow, that was a lot of seconds.
Yeah. Who did that?
Give it the box.
Okay. All right, motioned and seconded. Any discussion on waiving of second reading? Call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstain? Okay, so we're waiving second reading. So we go back to the motion. We're approving the motion to change the name of Graduate Education to the Graduate School. Any further discussion? Call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstain? Okay, we're done. Thank you very much. Okay. We have a third item, motion from Steering Committee to create an ad hoc committee on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Do I have a motion?
Move that the Senate create an ad hoc committee on diversity, equity, and inclusion in support of Strategic Plan Goal 4.
A second.
All right, motion and seconded. Discussion on this? Any question? I don't know if Joy was ready to talk about this, if we need to, but you're here. Yeah, okay. Oh, it's not you. It's Cynthia Myrie Coppin is here, too. Yeah, so come on up.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm Cynthia Myrie in the School of Business, Associate Professor of Management. And you all would have seen the charge, but there are a few things that I want to highlight about this ad hoc committee. The committee is being asked to be put in place to support strategic goal number 4, to develop specific recommendations and metrics to monitor OU's diversity, equity, and inclusion climate on campus. We would begin our work in the 2019-2020 academic year, and there will be a decision after that first few months of academic work about a petition for a potential standing committee or to extend the ad hoc status for an additional year. In particular, the committee would be charged with developing and refining metrics that would be used to monitor and evaluate OU's performance on faculty-related components of strategic goal number 4 and the strategic diversity plan. I want to kind of pause there for a moment because for those of you who are familiar with the diversity plan, it has student components. It has faculty components. It has staff components. And so this is primarily focused on faculty-related items. This committee would oversee and administer the university's Diversity Advocate Program for academic search. We've had good success with the program thus far, but it needs to be institutionalized a little bit more, and the committee would enable that. Members of this committee would serve as advocates both internally and outside of their departments, and also develop materials that would help us as a university to mitigate the effects of unconscious bias in recruiting, selection, and retention of faculty. We would review specific policies around things that create success in terms of an inclusive environment and things that work against the creation of a faculty-related inclusive environment. And finally, after those first few months of work, we will develop a specific charge that would go along with either a standing or an additional year as ad hoc. In other words, the more you dig into DEI, the more there is to do. And so we will take on that work of kind of bringing all of the faculty on board to see what other kinds of things do we want addressed. The membership of the committee would be very similar to other committees that we currently have. 4 faculty from the College of Arts and Sciences, a faculty from each school, the library, 2 at-large faculty, 1 department chair. The vice president would designate someone, as would the chief diversity officer. We'd have 1 AP and 2 students. And the recommendation around students would be 1 from Student Congress and 1 from the CMI Ambassador Program. And so I'll just pause and ask if there are any questions.
So David Garfinkel of Physics again. So I noticed the phrase within and also outside the department. So as you know, typically most of the work of a search is done within the department and relies heavily on the department-specific expertise of the people doing the search. So what sort of specifically can you do from outside the department to make searches more inclusive without, you know, having the expertise of the people who actually, you know, conduct the nuts and bolts of the search?
That's an excellent question. So what we have learned from our Diversity Advocate program this year is one of the things that the Diversity Advocate does is it ensures that the criteria for selection are stated up front. And then as the, whether that is diversity-related criteria, subject matter-related criteria, teaching-related criteria, et cetera. And as the diversity advocate works with the committee, they ensure that there's an equitable process where everyone is being asked the same questions and that the diversity statement or values concerning diversity are also included, and that unconscious bias is not being introduced into the system. So let me give you an example. You might have a search committee sitting around saying, well, why would they come here? Our salaries are so low. Well, your diversity advocate would say that is indicative of a little unconscious bias, and that's not our criteria. So we want to make sure that even though it's a physics person and I might be a modern languages professor, we don't want to use that as a reason to exclude someone from the search. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. Thank you.
Great. I want to commend Cynthia for the work she's done as our first provost faculty fellow in diversity. She's really been doing great work. Thank you.
I'd like to make a suggestion related to this. Since the steering committee will be making nominations, I would ask members of this body to contact your local friendly steering committee member with suggestions to make sure that we consider everyone that should be considered.
Great. Excellent. Okay, first reading, so we'll see it next month. Okay, thank you. Okay, we have a procedural motion, ad hoc committee charge of membership, procedural motion to staff Senate committees. Do I have a motion?
I'll move that we staff the Senate committee with okay. the people named.
Okay. Second?
Second.
Okay. Motion and seconded. You see the names, Tim Hodge, Darren Hanna, for general education and academic conduct, Julian Rushi. We'll take a vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same? Okay. Thank you. Motion carries. Good and welfare. Any items for good and welfare?
I just wanted to remind everyone that the call is out for Senate committees. If you can't find the open call that went out, it has been running in Friday announcements with the link, but you also can always go, always, to the Senate website, oakland.edu/Senate, and click on volunteer for a committee. It will take you right to the survey and you can volunteer from there. So those of you who have people that say, gosh, I wish I'd have volunteered earlier, all year long, they can go in and volunteer, and I do periodically pull that data down.
Dave Dulio, Poli Sci. Everybody probably knows Elizabeth Smart is on campus this evening. The hour before, though, you can go right next door and hear from one of the two United States congresspeople that represent Oakland University. Representative Alyssa Kinn is going to hold her first town hall meeting here on campus in Banquet Room A at 6 p.m. Thanks.
Very good. I see Stephanie back there, and I think I wanted to mention Founders Day happens, right? And what you know, what's the date? Do you know? April 17th. Just put it on your calendars, Founders Day, April 17th.
I'd like to remind everyone to RSVP for the Gagosian Luncheon. We have a very special honoree. Stephanie Lee is this year's honoree, so I wanted to make sure you remember that.
Wow, I better make sure I'm there. Okay. Congratulations. That's great.
So I just want to announce, and most of you have probably already seen this, that next Thursday evening is the annual Burke Lecture. This year, our speaker is Dr. Kwame Anthony Appiah, who's a philosopher, political philosopher from Harvard University, and he's going to be talking about identity politics. So that's next Thursday night in here, 7:30.
Any other items? All right. Without objection, we are adjourned. See you next time. Thank you. Thank you.